case is 98-235, the plan was stolen versus...
in the banking industry, that this may in fact be common.
and that's why this is such an important case. In fact, I believe it's the first fight in National Bank of Chicago being sued for damages because of this. The fact that it's not unusual reminds me of the famous statement by Mr. Chief Justice Taft in North County Hill versus Toomey, which is an old case from the 30s. The constant repetition of error is not a genocide. And that's exactly what we're talking about. If a number of banks are
going to be a bad industry, practice is a bad practice in your
it's a bad practice
or a terrible practice.
It's a terrible practice.
And you believe you should be on summary because you were disappointed.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And to allow a bank to punish a trust officer for following the public policy is to allow banks to kill the public policy. Bank order, 100% conversion, the felon refused. The punishment he suffered is set forth in the Court of Appeals opinion in pages 2, 3, and 4. It's quite clear. It's retaliation for doing the right thing. And the only difference between this case and the Mounting case is the bank asked Mr. O'Sullivan to stay. But if he stayed, he would have aided and abetted the unlawful behavior.
Why, I thought they offered him a different job. He wouldn't have to be involved in this.
No. He continued. They fired him from his position as head of the trust committee, and they fired him from his position as head of the investment advisors company. They made him a securities analyst, but they had him.
Wait a minute. Firing means permanently terminated.
Well,
they transferred him.
They demoted him.
Okay.
To the securities analyst.
I want to test your proposition of law, if I might, just for a minute. You go along the mere verbalization of all that, and you say, for his refusal to perform unethical, immoral, or illegal acts. Let's start with illegal. What was illegal about what they were doing?
In Ohio, it's unlawful for a trustee to breach his duty of fiduciary responsibility and of loyalty. It's unlawful to violate the prudent man rule in selecting investments for trust companies.
That's true in the whole world. Not just Ohio. Okay. But what specific illegal act means a violation of the law? Can you point to any law that says there couldn't be 100% conversion?
The prudent man rule is what
we go then to immoral. It's immoral because he says it's immoral. What if they say it's not immoral and others have done it?
All right. Immoral because the trustee deals with trust customers, pensioners, old people in nursing homes who have Alzheimer's disease.
But isn't there a cause of action by me as a fiduciary in a trust to come after the trustee, that is the bank, for reducing my benefits in my old lady's trust?
There's a cause of action not as by you as a fiduciary, but as a customer.
Well, it's a fiduciary.
You're in a position to be sophisticated, to realize being abused.
All right.
You've got Alzheimer's disease, and most folks home, you probably don't have that level of sophistication.
Well, you probably don't, but you have a guardian who does. And that's why it's appointed. All right. Now let's go to unethical. Are you equating unethical with immoral?
Well,
Is there any bank set of ethics?
There's a set of.
Maybe an oxymoron. But is there any set of ethics that says you may not convert?
Yeah, there's a set of ethics published by the Certified Financial Analyst Association, CFA, the Financial Analyst Association, CPA. And this violates those ethics. And if Mr. O'Sullivan had stayed, he would have violated the ethics of his profession. And,
okay, thank you.
Didn't the police, as Mr. Breeze correctly indicates, these transfers were not made before O'Sullivan left, were they?
As the court pleads, they were not made. He left a matter of a couple of weeks before the deadline for 100% conversion had been laid down by management. He left because he felt to stay would make him an aider and a better in this improper behavior.
So does the record indicate that the conversion was made after, they didn't close the personal and the common fund, did they?
In the record here, that is before the court, the record is that it was not made, although I understand the subsequently it may have been made.
Well, for that purpose, for his determination or his constructive of his determination to that, we'd be interested just in what happened before he left.
It was before he left, he left under the gun because of the retaliation and because he was right before the deadline for 100% conversion. He could not stay around without violating the ethics of his profession and become a leader or a member of this new property taken.
When this matter of deciding that it's a breach of his fiduciary duty, when such a thing is a matter of interpretation, in this case, it's intimated that your client had a peculiar personal interpretation that may have related to the fact that he was losing turf by doing this public fund instead of the private fund he'd managed. If it is a matter of his one particular person's interpretation of their own view of ethics, I'd call it doing the writer versus the right thing. What if they're both right? How should the law look at that?
I think it's pretty clear that they're not both right because the reasonable man standard is clear and no reasonable person would invest in higher risk, higher cost, lower returns, and impose liability.
It's clear, but of course the trial court found it clear the other way, so it's not so clear. It may be a matter of interpretation. The trial court found the other way, that there wasn't a clear no requirement of a clear violation of...
The
Court of Appeals didn't. I'm talking about...
The trial court relied upon the statute, but the statute is no different than the statute that said I can own a shotgun, but that doesn't mean I can use the shotgun to rob a bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you have a right to invest in these proprietary funds, but that doesn't mean you can do it in such a way as to abuse your trust customers, to breach your duty to the trust customers. And it's very clear, Your Honor. I respect your request, and I would send it back to the jury trial.
Thank you, Mr. Manning. Mr. Burke.
Thank you, Justice. Good morning. May I please report that we need to have a table. Two brief points, Justice Chief Justice Warner, in response to a couple of the issues you raised, just sort of clarifying. There were two conversions that were issued here. The first one, the only one that occurred, was a 401k pension plan type trust customer. This may have been correct because there obviously are no capital gains consequences for such employee benefit plans when you buy your own stock or move from one investment to the other. That's the only one that ever occurred. The personal trust fund conversion to Mr. Never heard at all. In this case, Mr. O'Sullivan, Mr. Manley Barnes, let me interrupt you there, was sat on the table to set a proposed plan of action when it was a proposed plan of action. It was proposed not just by Mr. O'Sullivan, but by several other trust officers, including Mr. Felton's testimony as part of the record. They raised legitimate tax issues, and that never occurred. Now, in the past couple of years, past 6 months, the Federal Revenue Service changed the tax law on those kinds of personal trust conversions to bankruptcy applicants. Here we have claimed that the man was never discharged. First, a constructive discharge, clearly an extraordinary remedy, and a discharge in violation of public policy, which is sitting here today, the court is very, very clear. The issue before the court is whether that claim can survive when the action that they have challenged on behalf of trial defense is the closing of an in-house or a mom-and-pop mutual fund, replacing it with a proprietary mutual fund with greater liquidity run by nationally recognized money managers, only after full disclosure to every single trust company, only after written authorization for that conversion by every single trust company. In a situation where not only is this not prohibited by a power law, but it's expressly sanctioned under 1111.13 of the Power Law Code. Simply the question is whether or not, under the circumstances of this case, there could be any claim for constructive discharge, as Justice Resnick described in the Mallory case, kind of coercion, involuntary discharge, but $125,000 a year executive is reassigned to a position, is asked continue to work on the investment opportunity transfers and cannot point to a single specific document of any harassment, maltreatment, or mistreatment. When he stayed for 5 months after the reassignment, he claimed to go into subjective pay policy. And when he did not see any profit, he was still setting up 3 weeks of one of his co-workers to set up a PhD fund.
These funds were moved, but these are reasonable.
performance wasn't better, that they didn't get benefit from having any more liquid.
So all that evidence goes back to maybe my first question, that this was ridiculous.
Absolutely. The only evidence, or the only thing that Mr. Van Lee and Mr. Rosal talked about is, yes, it's legal, but I think it's imprudent. If you look at the case they cite, because the room that they have specifically just told the state of Stephen King, 45 Highway 3rd, 376. The fruit and hand standard is not a restrictive standard. The fruit and hand standard is that that's anything that a reasonably prudent man would do, balancing any company capital preservation. That is an expansive discretion. The Stephen case goes on to say at pages 279 to 280, courts will not interfere with a trustee's discretion. Trustees don't get sued for investing in bonds, mutual funds from Vanguard versus mutual funds from Fidelity. Trustees do not get sued for preferring mutual funds to their common stock. There is not a single case. There's not a statute, there's not a rule, there's not a regulation, there's not a code of conduct. There is no objective standard, nothing, that says what we did, how we did it, what happened to these people, or anything else was wrong, proper, or not beneficial to them. To the contrary, the evidence is absolutely the opposite. If we cannot follow the rules of the enactment of the Ohio legislation, in the absence of some warning that what we're doing is inappropriate, we're following the law, there's no case saying what we did or how we did it, with the consent of all parties, and we filed that file review as inappropriate, and then we don't know, you know, frankly, as an Ohio lawyer, what can you look to be determinant of Obama's policy. I'd like to turn briefly, if I could, and Justice Draft's position. This is a simple disagreement over investment philosophy. There are many cases decided by courts of appeals here.
Let me interrupt you. There's an offer for performance. I noticed in your brief you indicate that Mr. Sullivan didn't have a very good record of his. He lost money at his fund, and he was certainly told by his superiors, you have problems, you know, just lost some customers, and this sounds a little bit to me like sour grapes, that he was really upset because the bank decided to set up a bigger fund and de-emphasize his fund, and it was sort of slapped in the face to him.
There's no question, Your Honor, that Mr. Sullivan is net down the record. Clearly what was going on here is you had a highly compensated value employee who was losing a fund over which he was the top man. It was now being farmed out to the best professional nationwide. Mr. O'Sullivan was a value member of the team. The evidence you refer to goes more to the construction discharge issue. But clearly from his managerial performance for next year before this issue arose, there were serious problems. But the fact of the matter, Your Honor, is Mr. O'Sullivan had no problems with the Riverfront Fund. Director Beal, he approved them, recommended them, he used them for his customers, he thought the fees were okay. There was no problem with the Riverfront Fund until they became the vehicle to replace the I believe that's a very important comment. But in the case we cite, Justice Grant, at page 28 and 29 of our brief, the Sardani case and the Eagle versus Denver case, Sardani is a situation where a psychiatrist offers to be more psychological care in prison compared to the patient to doctor ratio. Two valid views, one of which disagrees with the other. The court said that is not the kind of a policy when you have two subjective disagreements over two equally valid policies. As you said, right and right. Stephen versus Zimmer is a similar case. If I can briefly turn to the constructive discharge issue. Justice, again, we're not writing on a clean slate here. Justice Resnick has made it very clear that the absence of a constructive discharge is that the termination is coerced. The termination is involuntary. In the words of Malthus, working conditions are so intolerable that any reasonable person would feel compelled to resign. That any person would believe that termination is imminent. That is an objective standard. Subjective perception of the employee's working conditions are not sufficient if the objectively intolerable standard is not met. Again, clearly a case where that theory is not even approached. The mere verbalization issue just as illegal evidence of that. He then had the authority to come forward to show that there was. And you look at the record here in Your Honor, there is enough. He still kept his salary, he still kept his sentence, he had the same supervisor, he had the same office, he had been reassigned from his managerial duties, he still retained his investment authority duties. To the contrary, the senior executive vice president that was managed for the Vice Program. Nothing, I believe, could be more antithetical to an imminent termination or a constructive discharge than the interplay between Mr. Meyer and Mr. Lowell. The court of appeals is doing correct. Your Honor, apropos of the argument earlier today, this is a very well settled aspect of Ohio law, discharge violation of the public. It is reserved for places that it must be kept within rational limits. It is reserved for conduct that no employer should engage in and no employee should be subjected to. Nobody in Ohio has a problem with that proposition of law. However, that court, that claim that extended protection to workers in Ohio is cheapest and is based in every single turf war, every single philosophical difference. When we're even applying and applying the statute to the essence of any countervailing regulation or state law, to rise to the level and to be summary judgment under the same wrongful discharge violation of Ohio. This is not a case that is like the law. This case falls squarely within the court's daily presence. Clarity is the bedrock of this court. There must be a clear public policy. We would be held liable for violating the public policy for doing that which Ohio law expressly sanctions. If that is the law that is stated in this court in Ohio, I don't believe it is. We have to run with it. And the law is put in. Provident Bank is nothing appropriate here. Provident Bank took care of its trust customers, not a single trust customer, all the authorized inspections.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Manley, you've saved 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. It is true that notice was given to the managers of the pension plans because that's part of their federal whistle law. But there are thousands of pensioners out there that haven't any idea what's been going on. On the issue of whether or not the prudent man rule was violated, that is precisely a question for the jury to decide, not for the court to take away from the jury. Substantially, the only difference between this case and the Malady case is that in this case, both courts were impressed by the fact that the employer asked Mr. O'Sullivan to suspend. All the other facts are similar to the Malady case. And the matter should have been submitted to a jury to determine whether or not, in fact, there is a constructive discharge. To take away from the jury was, in my opinion, in conflict with the Malady case, which the lower court should be directed to follow. Bear in mind, from the beginning, the talk was, we're going to use the trust money to jumpstart these mutual funds that will be profitable from day one. It was abundantly clear from the beginning that the purpose was to benefit the bank, not trust customers. In those circumstances, of course, they are respectfully left the matter to be sent back to our
job. But before you can sit down and see where you present the argument the way I read the trial court, the court feels that things are both in agreement. The critical issue here is that the trial court went wrong on it. That's my constructive discharge.
That's a jury question. In other words, it should have been to a jury to determine whether there or whether not a constructive discharge. And the only factual difference here is that in this case, the employer said, we'd like you to sit. And now the employer says, we're going to transfer you to this other city to keep your same salary. The only difference.
So it's not a candidate for the summary on that question. And then the trial court also did find that the contract plaintiff's argument for reinvestment of an employee benefit on the trust fund is a proprietary mutual fund is not inconsistent
with that policy. Yes, and the trial court totally ignored the principle of prudent man rule or duty of loyalty. As a matter of fact, even the bank officers testified in that decision, they had no idea what the duty of loyalty was.
But your problem really is not a failure of the trial court or the court of appeals, but that you're asserting a public policy kind of claim.
Not really, no. It's the nature of the
Thank you, Mr. Manley. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.
Yes.